This podcast is in partnership with Design Biennale Rotterdam, Phoenix Museum, Lack of Guidance, Margreet Olsthoorn, New Institute and Rotterdam Partners, as they all share the common goal to create awareness, share opinions and empower creative growth.
The more you rush, sometimes the ideas don't get better. Absolutely not. Take time, take distance. On one side, design is great, but the students need to know that you are designing the hopes of people and that housing is a human right. And I think that's something really important that we also ask and that we also put it on the table. If you need help, ask for it.
Today I'm joined by Javier Arpe Fernandez, an architect, curator and academic shaping the future of architecture and urbanism. As head of the Building Audiences Group at TU Delft, Javier is on a mission to make architectural knowledge accessible beyond academia through exhibitions, publications and public talks. In this episode, he shares his journey from Madrid to Melbourne, his thoughts on education as a tool for change and how research, communication and action can transform the way we build our cities. Thank you for joining this podcast, Javier. How are you today?
I'm good. Excited about this interview. Finally, you made it happen. So very happy that we finally found a moment. Yeah.
How's life treating you?
Life is treating me well. I think I cannot complain. I think there are many others who are having much worse situations. It's not me to complain about it. All good. Yeah.
What's taking most of your attention at this moment?
Most of my attention right now is actually new steps I have to take in order to move forward in my professional career. I've taken certain decisions lately about what is going to happen next, so I have to work for it. So, you have to do administrative work at the university where I work, and then new projects coming, and all that needs preparation.
Can you reveal a little bit of what you're...
I start a new unit or group. It depends on universities. Some universities call it labs. Anyway, at the Faculty of Architecture in the University of Delft is called a group. So it's a new group within the Department of Architecture, which is going to be called, this is the title TBD still, Building Audiences. So I have to prepare for that. Yeah.
What does it mean?
Building Audiences aims at putting academic knowledge, what we teach to students, what we discuss among peers, outside or bring it outside the walls of the academia. I think we all agree in many topics. The university is extremely involved with how to fight climate change, things like that. But outside, societies or the general public are not that familiar with certain things we are sure of. And as an example, some vote for political parties who deny climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we, let's say, breach that breach? How do we take our knowledge outside by means of exhibitions, all sorts of dissemination, media, publications, writing, in a language that is understandable, no? That doesn't, how to say, provoke any rejection from those who are not familiar with the way we speak, with the way we write. So, yeah, that's what I would like to work with the students in the department, yeah.
Because education is quite a big part of you as a person in your career. Why is education so important for you?
This is what I do. I was actually not going to be an educator. When I studied architecture and I graduated, I wanted to work in non-conventional modes of practice. I think architectural practice can be curating, can be writing, can be editing, which is what I started doing. And there was a moment in which I ended up at university. Let's call it like that. This is where life takes you. I actually understood that educating others towards their future is a great way to do what I like, to do what I want. I think university allows for a certain freedom that other modes of practice don't allow. I think that the great thing about university is you have a little bit more freedom and time to speculate. Whereas other modes of practice, like conventional office, if I may call it like that, of architecture, needs to also respond to clients and need to build. So there's room to still think and speculate. We have a little bit more time. Of course, we have our other, deadlines, etc. But that's what I really love about educating. And also having younger generations in front of you. And I don't know if the right term is to be an example, no, but to communicate, to transmit things. And I think what is very exciting for me is when you are discussing with your students about things that maybe they are not that informed about and see them, let's say, start to be motivated and interested in doing something. No. They don't need to do what you are showing them, but they start to be motivated to research, to be more curious. And I think that's one of the things that is great about university, no? So to open the students' eyes, to then they can do whatever they want. But I think it's, we need to make them be curious.
Do you think the students that you teach are free in the educational program as it is right now?
It's a difficult question. I think students have certain freedom in the sense that universities or certain universities offer a diverse array of choices. You can, there's groups that do this, there's labs that do that. So there's a certain freedom to choose the kind of a studio you want to take. But of course, this freedom is limited as well, in the sense that you have to fulfill a certain curriculum, that you have to respond to what the studio objectives are. So there's less, freedom. But I think that once you have chosen a certain studio, yeah, of course, you have to follow the syllabus, you have to follow the curriculum, etc. But then it's you as educator who need to play with the possible freedoms. And this is where you have to, as I said, motivate the students and work with the student to see what is it what he or her is interested in. And then drive that, you know. And this is where you get the best results, no? When you actually extract the best from the student, given, let's say, the constraints within a certain studio. In the end of the studio, you need to produce whatever material, no? And this is something that, or there's certain requirements for graduation, etc. But I hope that we educators try to get the best out of the student. And in that sense, you can read a certain freedom there because he or she is actually doing what they want. They are more interested in.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work with that. You cannot impose certain things. You have to work with what they are interested in, especially in the higher levels of the masters.
In your work and your career, you're very much involved in themes like research and innovation and vision. So creative thinking is always there at your side. Is freedom also enabling yourself that you're free of mind, that, for instance, you teach your students more on mental health and such? Is this something, a theme that you do a lot in your education, or that educational institutes should do more?
It's a very good question. That's something that is a topic which is becoming more and more present in institutions, and in particular at Delft. So in the last years, especially since the pandemic, when we had big health, not only mental, but big health issue, health became something more and more present in our daily conversations. No? So the institution has taken certain measures to safeguard the mental well-being of all, not only students, but all members of the community. And I see in the last, say, 5 years, more and more initiatives happening towards taking care of well-being. That's something we let's say we think studio or design is not part of exactly what we do, take care of the mental health of the students. There's other specialists in the institution, in the faculty, who do take care of that, where the students can go. But it's nevertheless something that we address in the sense that we talk to them about how much they must work, how many hours they need to devote to working with us, and how many hours or how much time, or in a way, you also remind them, hey, you need to take some free time. Why don't you go out? Why don't you take the weekend off? Very recently, I had a conversation with a graduating student of ours who, was going through a lower moment. Let's put it like that, not give any more details. We had a very nice conversation, and I said, just get out, just put your project aside, leave the school, forget about it, come back in 3 days, do whatever you like to do best. I don't know, whatever it is, just do it and then come back. And then only then we talk, only then we keep talking about it. Sometimes it's not that we are trained to take care of the mental health of the students. I wish, but that was not part of my formation. So to be very sincere, but there's a human factor, no? We're all human beings. And in the end, when you realize that the students are very stressed, there's many ways in which they let you know. You need to act. That's something. You need to react. And you need to put boundaries to the amount of work that you're asking from them and make them feel safe. Safe is a word that has been maybe overused in the last times, but make them feel that you are not they're chasing them for more and more and more work, no? That you have understood that they are doing a lot already and that they need time for other things. Yeah, I think we need all to be careful. And going back to your more general question, the faculty itself is taking measures at a higher level in order to guarantee that the students and all of us are in, let's say, good conditions, no?
What are good conditions?
I would say that workload should be monitored. This is something that is being looked at. How many hours we end up spending because we have to do this and that and that and that. There's a lot that we do besides just being with the students. We need this amount of time that we are working is being monitored throughout surveys. How much time do you actually spend doing this and that? And then we receive reports. Reports saying, you all are working too much. So there's measures that need to be taken so that the work is done better, more efficiently, and at the same time that we can get out of work, do other things, you know? There's many modes of work, I would say. In my case, I love working.
Yes, let's focus on you.
Yes. In my case, I love working so much. Many times my free time has to do with thinking about future projects. But let's not take that as an obligation, which is maybe a difference there, no? The idea of obligation. The capitalistic, let's say, scheme of working hours, etc., etc. But what I think is relevant is that employers, like our institution in this case, is following closely how much workload or stress the workers are going through. No? In my case, I do other things besides the institution, and I do it.
Not a good example?
Or? No, maybe. No, I don't think that I'm not a good example. I do what I want. So in that case, I'm fine. I have certain obligations with my employer. And then I do work for free or my own work. And that's great. And I like it. I do what I like. I do swim a lot. And I reserve time for swimming every morning, every day of my life, if I can. As much as I do reserve time to try to think of new projects coming in the future. And that's for me, my swimming as well. So I don't think that's a bad example. Some may say, no, outside working hours, I do other stuff. I go, I take my bicycle, I may be sitting at home or in bed trying to think of what is it I'm going to do next. But yeah.
Well, answered 5 questions already. I know you a bit and I know how passionate you are about your work, about the next generations, current generations. But I always wonder, how does he do it? All the traveling worldwide, Australia, Brazil, you mentioned. And how do you keep up in a mental state? And I believe now to hear that swimming is an important part of it. Is this also something that you, in a formal way, give to your students? Like, whatever you do on this project that we're working on together, please focus on doing your sports or such. Because what I learned through the years is that traditional education is very much in, well, not drilling, but building personalities with their human capital skills, and then they fly out of the nest and they do their thing. But actually managing yourself instead of just the skills that you learned as a profession, I see it so many times that people fall. And I just wonder, how much of your personal experiences do you put in the educational programs, even if it's not on paper?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you make a very right distinction, what you write on paper, what we write in a syllabus of a design studio, for instance. But then there's conversations, no? There's a moment in which we are discussing with the students about many things. Don't only talk about their precise project, you know, but how do you manage time, you know? This conversation, this is maybe a topic that is not on the syllabus per se, but then you need to discuss with the students, how do you manage your time? And then I give my own example, you know, but sometimes it's best. I answering one of your questions, I follow my morning routine in a sacred way. So there's nothing that is going to, there's nothing, but let's not be that absolutistic, but there's very little things that make me not do my morning routine, which is time for myself in the swimming pool, no matter where I am. So the first thing I do when I go somewhere, which I do very often, is to look where the closest public swimming pool is. That's my routine. And that is a little bit what guides me on a daily basis. And after that, anything can go, anything can happen. And I use this as an example for students. Of course, you can do swimming. You can do whatever makes you happier. Huh? And managing your time. This is an example I give to them, no? And this is what is not maybe written in the syllabi. But that's something that I said, as an educator, you need to communicate. And as I was mentioning earlier, you have to tell your students, hey, take some time off. Let's meet next week. Go out. Also, because what happens when you see the student who is very stressed, stress doesn't really lead to any kind of good results. You are just, I don't know, turning around in circles. Not only students, all of us do. So sometimes you need to move out from what you are doing and then go back. You know?
How do you do this yourself?
I take a swim.
And then it's gone?
No, I do take a swim. I actually change topic. I have enough things to do. So sometimes when there's sort of a writer's block or there's an idea that doesn't come, no, I don't know, we produce exhibitions. I produce several exhibitions per year. And sometimes it's like, what is it I'm going to talk about next? I don't know. I don't know what the next exhibition should be. The idea for the next exhibition actually came this morning when I was in the water. But then you do something else. You let it sleep for a little bit. And what I have learned, and it has taken me some time, is to really let it sleep for a little while, not get obsessed with recurrent thinking about, okay, I have to solve that. I have to solve that. What's the next idea? What's the next idea? That doesn't happen, at least in my case. And this is all very personal. Others have their other ways of working. But in general, I let it sleep, go to do something else. This is what I was doing actually today because I didn't know what to answer to a couple of things. And then come back to it with a fresher mind. And always, I think it's really good in my case, I read a lot. So if I have something like there's curiosity or ideas that come to mind, but you don't really know how to develop them, just try to search a little bit about the topics or ideas or intuitions. So it is really, really necessary in my case to read, really read. I mean, we are surrounded by lots of books here, and which is not even half of the books I have. Picking something, an article from here, an article from there, helps me move forward with the next idea. In this case, the example is an exhibition. And this is something, what I'm telling you now, this is the kind of discussions that you may end up having with students. Okay, you give your own example, sometimes is is the most direct thing, no? Besides talking about their project itself. Of course, we spend most of the time talking about urban design ideas, future cities, etc., how to do what they are doing. But when it comes to, okay, you don't know what to do, think of something else. You don't know what to do, get out. So this is what I was just explaining, which I apply for myself. I try to communicate to the students, hoping that is useful also for them.
Let's try to break this down for someone who is listening and they just heard this or spoke to you before. You said take a swim, take a break, a couple of days, try to get some rest, inspiration. So we hear it right now. We finish the podcast and then we try to be calm, not stressed about the challenge that is actually on the table. Do something which is taking distance from the challenge and then try to find inspiration or distractions or whatsoever. How did you learn this? Because what I can imagine is that you think, yeah, thank you, Javier, for the tip. But the problem is there, and it's so much in my mind that I can't even put it aside. What could we come up with as a tip to do so? Picking up the book is easy, but actually to read it and absorb it and think that that was a great idea, thank you. What is it that we learned over the years that we can give as a tip?
In my case, I know what being impatient is. I have learned not to be that impatient. If you tell a 25-year-old person, don't be impatient. Like I can tell my students, don't be impatient. I don't know if even I, when I was 25, somebody tells me, don't be impatient. I would just don't care. Probably, no, fine. That's an old guy saying me. Sounds like a daddy or a father's advice. But I have learned to really not be impatient. But that's something that probably, and this is something that we hear again and again and again, and this is like the human condition, no? And the human condition is that at 25, we are very impatient because we want to do many, many things. And when we are 50, we have already gone through more experience, realizing that The more you want to rest, maybe sometimes won't help you. So it's better not to stress about it, because if you stayed seated, have to have that idea done, that I have to deliver. Maybe you have to be in front of 100 occasions like that in which rushing didn't work, to then advise others not to be impatient. So I don't have an answer. My answer is you need to learn not to be impatient, move out, get away, do something else. But at the same time, I fully understand that that age, somebody just wants to be impatient or wants to or can't help it.
How did you learn that swimming and the discipline and actually the habit of doing so worked for you? You didn't decide on Monday and for the rest of my life.
No. It happened. And then you learn. It's a progress. It's a learning curve. And then you start or you learn to control certain, modes of doing, certain emotions. And also you use help from professionals, which I did in my case. So, and I think that's something really important that we also ask. And that we also put it on the table. If you need help, ask for it. You mentioned mental health. Mental health in a great deal of the Western world is still a taboo. So we don't mention depression. We don't want to talk about it. I think, for instance, when it comes to physical conditions like cancer, it's becoming less of a taboo. We are mentioning the word cancer more and more often. And that's also thanks to the media, etc. Some maybe reference as persons who have come out saying, I have cancer. And you call it cancer. Don't call it a lung disease. Okay. So I think we should be less euphemistic about mental health and really address it. And this is what we have probably learned from the pandemic. And this is why we're going back to a previous answer, no, or question about mental health in our institution. I think that maybe this is going too far. Maybe, of course, stress-related, work-related issues do not mean that you have a mental health condition. But maybe you do have it. And it's very, very important to acknowledge it, address it, and ask for help. So in that case, if a student or if a professional, if a human being has a mental health issue, don't hesitate to ask for help. And if I can give an example, and I don't mind, I asked for help in several occasions, and it was really great. So I was actually in the hands, let's say, of someone, of a professional, who helped me try to understand how to control thoughts and emotions. And that was great. And I learned to be less impatient. But what I'm trying to say is that you don't need to go to a professional psychologist or psychiatrist to control your emotions or your thoughts. You also learn to be less impatient or rush less by means of learning from experience. And again, sorry if I'm repeating myself, you really learn that the more you rush, sometimes the ideas don't get better. Absolutely not. Take time, take distance. 25, I don't know if that's it.
This is the reason why I asked you. Not that I expected this answer, but I think it's a perfect example of being in search of yourself. And that's why I find this skill, research and writing and such, so important, because it's part of the reflection. But it also shows that although it's your profession, it doesn't guarantee in any way that you can develop yourself as a human being. Recently, you initiated the exhibition Sharing Intimacies, which featured five artists with backgrounds in architecture who offered unique perspectives and expressions on themes such as human connection, body and identity, empathy and storytelling. Why did you organize this?
So this idea came indeed because one of the, as curator of public programs of the Faculty of Architecture, we have been looking at aspects or ideas or topics of urbanism, architecture, the built environment. And there was a moment this winter in which we actually, one of the things that I also try to do with public programs is to bring extracurricular topics to the house through the BK Talks. We have had a couple of BK Talks on well-being, actually. Other aspects that are not that disciplinary, no? I remember one which was called Apocalypse. Another one was called Not in My Backyard. So they address, let's say, tangentially the built environment, but the responses of society and the general public to our ideas within the Faculty of Architecture and the built environment. In the case of Sharing Intimacies, we went a little bit further in the sense that let's do something that has nothing to do with the built environment. Let's select a few former architects whose practice has moved towards art. And not only towards art, not only to, let's say, photography of the built environment, no, again, but let's choose architects who do work, artwork, about their selves, about their bodies. And this is, as you were mentioning, let's talk about intimacy, let's talk about our complexes, about things that obsess us. And it was a really interesting experience because we had, and it was a way to also show students, it is an educational experience, because what we tried with the public programs at the end is part of an educational program. Of course, sharing intimacies is not in anywhere in the curriculum, but at the same time, the students could see for 4 weeks that you can be an architect and expose your body and talk about your body or talk about your fears, talk about death. This is what one of the artists was talking about. Or another artist was explaining or trying to expose his intimate love relationships throughout years, which is what we all go through at the end, no? Or somebody else showing her body parts that she never shows, no? And we printed these large form images of body parts. And that's an architect who decides to show body parts. And I think that's architecture as well. So finally, another architect, expose her body, but expose her body live during the performance, no? And I think that was an extremely interesting experience, getting out from the written curriculum. It was a moment in which, I don't want to intellectualize this too much. It was a moment in the winter in which we said, enough built environment per se. Let's look at ourselves, you know, let's share obsessions, fears, bodies. So it was a very beautiful, especially the opening. The artists were explaining what they did, how they felt. And then it was followed by a BK Talks in which people share intimate things, if I may call them like that. We said not actually share within a academic environment or university in which conversations, for logical reasons, are elsewhere, no? So I think that also liberated those participants, students and the audience, from a certain stiffness, let's say. The academic stiffness, you talk about your project, you talk about your housing, you talk about your park or what you have designed. And then you see yourself discussing or sharing a terrible experience. No, I remember we were interviewing each of these architects. Two of them are still studying or were students or graduates from TU Delft. I remember preparing the exhibition when one of them was showing his work, and I had to cancel the call for a minute because I started crying. Because it was, I don't mind saying, he was talking about death and a really extreme experience that he had had with death, and which he showed in his part of the exhibition. It really triggered emotions to everybody in the room, of course, and me personally, I had to say I need a couple of minutes out because this is getting too emotional for me, no? So I think that it's not about doing this all the time, but every now and then acknowledging that we as architects are human beings that can share what I already mentioned, I think it's great. I don't think I'm going to be doing all the time this. I think I really want to touch other aspects, but it was really a great experience. Also, from the point of pure design, the exhibition design, I think, is one of the best that we did so far in the public programs. We are extremely happy, you know, the team was incredible. Everyone in the team and also the artists that contributed were extremely happy that this experience happened. No, so let's see what happens in the coming years.
You studied 1 year in Helsinki.
Yeah.
Why?
Because one of the greatest creations of the European Union, which I defend with all my heart and all my brain, is the Erasmus program. I think that the Erasmus program was the best idea the European Union had in order to make Europe happen. So I was sent as an Erasmus student from Madrid to Helsinki. I was given two choices. I don't remember the other. But I had this professor who told me, no, you go to Helsinki. I come from Madrid, which is a very big city. You're going to be in nature. I'm going to send you there. And I said, okay, let's go. And it was an incredible, incredible experience because I experienced a winter at minus 25 or something like that. I would walk the frozen Baltic with my friends on the ice. And then I discovered a way of understanding nature by the Finns, which was completely unknown for me, how nature is part of identity. I didn't know that before. I come from a very big city, and I always live in the very center of a very big city. And I was always fascinated about big cities. And then I was living in a forest with pine trees, and the campus is beautiful. I also discovered Alvar Aalto and a certain side of modernism which was not that much, how to say, made visible in the school of Madrid where I came from. So I discovered a side of modernism which I still believe in enormously. So yeah, after that year, what was great about Helsinki is that a group of students, this is 1990s, and a group of students there from different places in Europe, we decided that we did not want to go back to the places where we came from. And from Helsinki, we all moved together to Delft. And we decided to do our masters here at the University of Delft. Back then, Delft or the Netherlands was the place to be.
Why?
Innovation, architectural experimentation. Of course, OMA had already been doing a lot of great work. And the new offices like MVRDV were just a start. And then it was all, let's say, next to in the neighborhood of TU Delft. And we decided to move here. This was really, really back then, the place to be in terms of architectural experimentation. So actually getting out of Madrid, moving to Helsinki, made me end up here.
Well, Helsinki is quite important for you.
It's the trampoline or the, yeah. I don't know how you, it was the trigger that pushed me out of where I came from, place which I still love. Yeah, the path, you know, it went that way, Helsinki, then the Netherlands, and then everything else.
Did you ever send students like yourself at that moment to places where you thought like, this is good for you, or are you gonna do this?
Yeah, when they ask me about schools or places to go, I always give my opinion, which is sometimes I try to be as objective as possible. But of course you have certain, I don't know, if a student comes, I do recommend my students to go to Japan a lot.
Why?
I love Japan. I really like Japan, and there's a certain sensitivity and that is really worth learning from. Whenever students say, there's an exchange in Tokyo, I say, just go. Just spend 1 year in Japan. The example I try to give my students is that traveling, moving out, is extremely an essential part of the formation of, I don't think all of only a designer or an architect, I think it's that of anyone. I think traveling breaks many walls and makes boundaries a lot more, how to say, blurry. There's no black or white anymore. And I think that I would really send a lot of people to travel a lot, you know, who are ruling us nowadays, like just go travel a little bit. I think it's really an enriching experience. So I do recommend places. I also recommend students to go to France. I actually don't think there's this one or this other place. I think that the experience of doing it is already extremely enriching. So just getting out of your zone of comfort, the place where you have grown up, it can be anywhere. But just the change, you know, it's radically transforming who you are, no matter where you go. Of course, I can advise Tokyo, but it can be any other place. It's just the voyage, you know, the journey. In my case, I can't stop traveling because of that. I don't know, it wakes curiosity. I'm always thinking for me, it's actually a little bit stressful not to know that I'm not going to be somewhere soon.
So, interesting.
For me, that's how I have learned to live. Learn to live, I mean, that's a big, big word. But I have learned, or I feel emotionally, how to say, calm, and I can work a lot better. Much more motivated knowing that next month I'm going to be there and that the following month this is coming in another place. So wanderlust is one of my big, I don't know if you call it an issue.
How was the pandemic?
The pandemic was extremely, extremely tough. Very, very tough. I was alone in Rotterdam. My parents and I, we decided that I wouldn't go back to Spain where my family is. My father is a doctor, so then they are old. And my father said, I don't think it's a good idea that you move here because we are much more at risk. This is completely uncharted territory. We are much more at risk because of our age than you are. So I don't think it's a good idea that you move here. The Spanish government, just like other European governments, shut down the borders. And I received this email one day. You as a Spanish citizen have the right to come back, but you need to do it within the coming, I don't know how many days. And I decided not to, so I locked myself in. The swimming pool was closed, so I couldn't go swimming. I couldn't see almost anybody. So it was a very hard situation. I bought myself a rowing machine, and I would row and row during the first pandemic, during the first lockdown, I mean. And I was completely about myself. So it was like a little bit of a Robinson Crusoe experience. I would go to the supermarket and try to talk to the checkout man or woman there. They were a little bit like, what? But I had very little human contact because of my personal situation, in which I was, or I am, I live alone. So it wasn't easy. No.
You have quite a solid system of habits, like the swimming, the traveling. Then the pandemic hits and basically everything that you have is not there anymore. How did you deal with this? Mm. Because I think that this is happening with a lot of students. You say, like, take a break, but between taking actually the break and the conversation that you had?
Oof, that's a tough question because that's...
I know.
Yeah. It's not a tough question. It was a very tough moment. So it's difficult to explain. It was very hard, really hard to wake up every morning listening to... I was mostly for some... I mean, for emotional or family reasons, I was listening to the Spanish radio every morning, where they would give you the amount of people dying. So that was like the first thing that I would listen to in the morning. And then it's a complete new situation. So basically you hold on to those you love and are in contact with them. So I can think of one person who I love very, very, very much, who was at that time in Rotterdam, who also living alone, and with whom we spent a lot of time walking outside in the street when it was allowed. So you try to find a support in those you love and who love you. I think that's, this is very basic. I guess that everybody does it. I remember I was learning to sleep. A friend of mine sent me some mindfulness guide, but it was great because I couldn't do the exercises. I would fall asleep immediately. So that was great. Basically, I would wake up every morning not understanding what was happening, especially the first 2-3 weeks. The first month was very tough. Yeah. It's very, very, you felt very lost. Mm. Also knowing that that you couldn't go back home. I still consider Madrid home. And the fact that, because that's also my escape route. I live here for many years, but any moment for me, I push the red button, I go. And the idea that safe, I mean, this is becoming too personal now, but let's see. That safe haven is not there anymore because the borders are closed. That was extremely difficult. For me, as I'm trying to explain, I am fine as long as I know that I can go there any moment, door to door. It's 4 hours. So the fact that I couldn't do that was extremely stressful. Yeah, extremely stressful.
Are you a safe haven for others?
At different levels, yes. I mean, what I just explained is a very intimate thing. And I think that you are that for maybe one or two persons or few in your life at that level. But then at other levels, I know that as an educator, you have a certain role to be the safe haven of the students that work with you, no, or you work with. And at a certain level, of course, you become their advisor at a certain level, I insist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank mm-hmm. you. A or B, do or die questions.
Yeah.
Writing or teaching?
Writing.
Are you rational or more romantic?
I was more romantic. Not anymore.
More visionary or problem solver?
Used to be more visionary, now you solve a lot of problems. No. That's how things evolve.
Are you a risk taker or more conservative?
Risk taker.
Yeah?
It's 100%.
Independent research and publications or full-time in education?
Independent research and publications.
Research methods. Traditional surveys or big data analytics?
None.
Think tanks. Independent or government-funded?
They can be independent, but publicly funded, and I believe in the public sector.
Supporting students, counseling service, or teacher training?
In between. There's no black or white.
Mental health in education, dedicated classes, or integrated curriculum?
Integrated curriculum.
Team sports or individual sports?
Individual sports.
Become the chief editor at any place you choose, or be the head of a new educational platform at any institute you prefer? You find it hard?
It is a very hard question.
Why is it hard?
Because you are describing my two professional aspirations and having to choose. Let's try to combine it.
For the first question, writing or teaching, it was quite clear for you that it was writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to ask this one, how, okay, it's in a leading position, it's not actual doing. But what makes the difference for you?
You can write within academia. That's a big difference. And that what you are describing as an editor-in-chief, or it sounds like it's more for an institution or a company. And the other thing is my next step in my professional career. So I would like to stay at university, develop my group in which I can write. It is a very difficult answer.
What if he never went into architecture?
I would have studied art history, for sure. I would have studied art history in this is a question that I already answered to many. I would have studied art history and then moved to the US, do a master's in art history and try to run a museum.
Would you still consider it?
Time is a little bit against me. I know that we live long, etc., but that's time is a little bit against me.
How much time do you need?
A few years to build a different career. I said I love taking risk. I could do it, and I should think about it.
What if you never engaged in research or writing?
Woof! That my life would be a lot more boring. That's for sure. I come from a family of researchers, scientists, asking questions and trying to find some answers, some solutions, etc. is what I learned to see or I saw at home. So I would have practiced research in a different way, probably, but I once wanted to be a doctor, medical doctor. So without it, I don't think there's a... I would have practiced research in a different way.
How have you personally been influenced by Ai Weiwei coming from Spain and Madrid? Well, I know the answer a little bit, but I found it quite striking what you said in an introduction to Ai Weiwei for the TU Delft.
Well, that's what I precisely described, no? So the fact that I grew up in a neighborhood in Madrid from which every morning I would see Francisco Franco's mausoleum. That's still a very marking personal story. I always wonder why Spain was still allowing a dictatorship be worshipped by his partisans for 40 years in a mausoleum that was in front of my parents' home. When my parents fought against fascism all their lives. They tried to explain me, of course, but I never found an answer. Why the cross? Why could fascists just still keep going and going and going and going to celebrate that man's dictatorship? Until one day, I found a picture from the perspective series by Ai Weiwei, which he shows one finger to that cross. And for me, that was really, really marking in the sense, what's the power of design? That's design. It's art. The power of design to actually put things on your face, no? And when Ai Weiwei, or when I saw Ai Weiwei's image, I actually was so inspired in the sense that look what art can do, you know? Look what somebody so courageous as Ai Weiwei, it doesn't require only the artistic capacity, it's also the courage. Ai Weiwei's courage to publish that picture, but not only that one. We all know what the series contained. The series starts with the same finger in Tiananmen Square in front of Mao Zedong's portrait. What he is telling us, no, is that you are artist, that you have this creative capacity, but how you channel it, that's another thing, no? Yesterday or day before yesterday, I follow Ai Weiwei's Instagram account, and he published his picture, his selfie with Julian Assange. He did it, and we all know why. So not only the enormous creativity of the man, I'm not going to discuss that. I didn't study art history, so I won't mention that. But not only the artistic creativity or his work, but the courage of the person to tell others what's happening. For me, that was extremely inspiring. It keeps inspiring me.
Mm-hmm.
So I still try and, you know, what I try to do is to communicate to others things like the climate crisis. You know, we all agree that the climate crisis is happening. But how many others don't even believe there's a climate crisis? No, this knowledge needs to be communicated. And in that sense, and it's a very different level. Of course, what Ai Weiwei is doing is extremely more risky. In that sense, I admire him. And that was a very, marking moment of inspiration for me to try to be as little as courageous as possible, if you know what I mean, as Ai Weiwei. That's what I learned from him. He inspired me in the sense that if he does that, risking his life, I should do at least half of it. But not only Ai Weiwei, some other people inspired. And I think there's an important role that we educators have in order to not communicate pure disciplinary aspects. I also try to communicate my students that the fabrication of the city is a political act. I mean, the city in which we are is a result of political decisions. If there was a different government, there would be other city in front of us, no, out of the window. So polis in Greek means city. And it's the root for the word politics. I think that's something that we cannot deny nowadays. We are in the middle of not only the climate crisis, but so many other urgencies. Inequality or inequity, social segregation. And that has to do so much with space. How can we talk about social segregation without talking about how that actually materializes in cities or vice versa? How does urban design trigger segregation, no? So things like that. Or the role of density. I've been publishing publications and writings about density since I started my professional career, no? I started as an editor at A+T doing the density series, no? And how much living in a dense city changes the results of a political election, no? If you look at suburbs, and what is voted in the suburbs, but what is voted in the cities, that tells you, no? I just give you the example of the results of the Trump election in 2016, where he was elected, no? Or the results of voice referendum in Australia last October, what the core of the cities voted versus what the suburbs or the countryside voted, no? So urban form, which is what we teach, has an enormous repercussion on the lives and the decisions of people. And that's something that we cannot, let's say, deny or try to forget, no, somehow. And that's where I stand now with practice.
What is research, communicate, and act all about?
Exactly this. So Research, Communicate, Act is the subtitle of my PhD for starters, but it's a lecture that I've been giving in the last years. And that's where I am at now. This is where I'm trying to organize as a lab at the university. No, I give you an example. I am now starting a project that has to do with indigenous intelligence. Indigenous intelligence is, or I call it indigenous intelligence. You can, let's say, Aboriginal knowledge. There are many, many ways. So in Australia, there's the concept of country, you know. What I'm very interested in is to, first of all, understand what country is in a place like Australia, which is the knowledge of the Aboriginal peoples, the First Nations that were there before the colonizers arrived, whose knowledge was completely obliterated and deleted, and how much that knowledge of nature, territory, landscape, but not only landscape, being, ways of behaving, relating to others, organizing societies, etc., how much that indigenous knowledge that has been transmitted orally for millennia in Australia was completely removed from the, let's say, mainstream, the colonization, then after colonization, etc., and how little nowadays it's present in the fabrication of the cities, no? In particular, the city of Melbourne. So what I'm trying to do is to research about that, try to see where the traces of that knowledge are in the city of Melbourne, then make an exhibition about it, which is communicate, and then invite the visitors, the policymakers, and society to really understand that all that knowledge that is there, that is part of the Aboriginal culture, will dramatically help building the future of the city of Melbourne. I'm talking about urban design, but urban design from the point of view of the application of an Aboriginal knowledge that was censored, cancelled, I don't know how to call it, eliminated, I mean, by means of genocide, all you all means, no? And this is something I'm really excited about. I don't still control the terms. Probably somebody was like, that is not country. That is not knowledge. Yeah, but that's what I'm learning. And when you are researching something, you need to acknowledge that you know nothing, but also work with that lack of knowledge and curiosity. So I'm so curious about Aboriginal knowledge. It's what I'm trying to understand now. I do the research. Then I'm going to make an exhibition full of mistakes. Fine. Well, full of mistakes. Oh, you lack information here. You lack information there. This is not exactly correct. But I will have put that conversation in the middle of the city of Melbourne, because that's where the exhibition is going to take place. And then the discussion can start. Fine if they or some people say, you should have also considered. Of course, when in order to move forward, you need to select, and sometimes you remove things that you have added. That's what you do in curatorship or editing, etc. But anyway, research, communicate, act. That's in three, the three words that I use to explain this work I'm doing. And this is what I try to also teach my students, or I will try to teach my students. Be curious. Communicate it and invite others outside the university to do something about it.
Sounds really nice. Mm. Thank you. Would it also be possible to do it without a PhD? Why a PhD?
It would be possible to do it without the PhD. But the PhD allows you to depend enormously on this idea. That is when you take the time to really build a body of research and work. So I think that the PhD is in my case, it's an extremely useful. I'm doing a practice-based research PhD. It allows me to look at what I have done and revise it and repackage it. Sorry, that word sounds very ugly. Repackage it in order to try to understand how me, Javier, has been doing research communication and call to action in the last 20 years of professional career. So it allows you to deepen on why you do it. What are the others that are also doing the same? No, what is the community of practice? And really try to unfold what is your contribution to knowledge, no? And have a document, if I may call it like that, that anybody can read in order to learn, no? That is my contribution to knowledge, so that others decide also to research, communicate, act. And I think in my case, that's how I understand the PhD. What is my contribution to knowledge, to others? That publication will be, I think it's open source even, so.
Next to Aiwaiwai, you mentioned that you had other inspirations. Can you name the things or the people? And did you also had a mentor?
Mentor, I don't know. There are people that I now admire enormously, and people who taught me many, many things. I need to acknowledge the role of Aurora Fernandez Per. She's the director of A+T, and I think it was an incredible intellectual professional mentor. So I will always thank her. I never told her in person. So maybe if she hears this, then she will. We haven't spoken in many, many, many years.
What did she do for you?
Oh, she taught me how to write. So she taught me how to write, how to use verbal expression to communicate ideas. And then she told me, not only that, she taught me to have an agenda. And then with that, only when you have that agenda, you research. You want to do a research because you want to tell something. You have an agenda about, in that case, I imagine it was density. And it was very much of an intuition. If we don't live in a dense city, I mean, there will be a moment in which there will be no more planet. Back then, it was a little bit of an intuition. Nowadays, of course, it's a much more of a total crisis, no, or an emergency, but it was not considered as such that back then. There's an agenda, no, about how cities should grow. And only then you start looking for those architectures or designs that fulfill that agenda that you have. And this is where the publication comes. I learned it all from her. Yeah. So I'm still very, very grateful.
What are you most proud of in your career till so far?
Proud of? I think that project-wise, I think that I'm very, very proud of the exhibition Paris Habitat that I was commissioned by the city of Paris. It took place in the Pavilion de l'Arsenal. I first of all learned a lot. I think that was my first PhD. It was 3 years of archiving and mining in the archives of one of the largest social housing agencies in Europe and in the world, Paris Habitat. So I was asked to make an exhibition and a book about 100 years of social housing. I have done a lot of social of housing investigation before. That's why I was called to do it. I was also called, I used to live in Paris, but I also asked to do this work also in a way because I was a foreigner and they appreciated the fact that somebody from outside would come to do that research. It was an incredible experience, as I said, 3 years trying to understand housing production throughout 100 years, thousands of buildings even. Then to show it in a certain way and be able to communicate visitors the immense patrimony that the city of Paris still has and the immense capacity that the city of Paris is still deploying in order to keep affordable housing within a city which is extremely expensive, as we all know. No? So I have always defended social housing. And then Paris, Vienna are one of the few, bastions where these policies keep being implemented, no? I still, do use many of those arguments from that work, that research, in my current work, no?
What makes you feel so proud about doing such a project? Is this?
First of all, having done it. So it was 3 years of entering a very complicated ground in which architecture and urban design mix with politics. Okay, so you have to work for a very, very, very official institution, no? That represents the city.
It's the difficulty of the project.
Yeah, that makes it difficult because you have to manage an institution. Or you manage, not manage an institution, but manage how you want to present work at a very consolidated and official public institution, no? So you need to polish and take care of language, no? My French is actually, it's good. It's good. But then, of course, the institution says that's not really institutional French. You need to, you know, so that's complicated to navigate. So it was a challenge. It was really a challenge.
Now that you learn this, because Ai Weiwei gave the middle finger, which makes you more like a rebel-ish. How did you learn this very polished and nurturing approach?
I think I already learned it before, and that comes from my father. So how to navigate different personalities, languages, perspectives, sensitivities. So you need to be very cautious. I think that's one of the things that I do better, is try to navigate from institutions, politicians, egos, personalities, etc. You need to do it nicely and carefully, but also clearly, with the truth. I'm not saying anything else. You need to use a lot of, in Spanish we say left hand. I don't know what it means. You need to be, accept that people in front of you can be very, very, very different. And still you have an idea. And how do you make it? How do you materialize that idea? It's something that you need to learn to navigate. It takes time, right? It takes years. Sometimes the conversation with the institution was like, okay, no, we need to change design. We need to change the catalog. We need to change designer. That was not easy. But you end up being proud the day that is open. And I was very, very proud, even more proud, because on the day of the opening of that exhibition, still there were hundreds of people outside the institution demonstrating for more affordable housing. No, so people were actually saying, fine, you can have your celebration inside the museum, but still, we need more affordable housing. That had been triggered, speaking of Research Communicate Act, that triggered a reaction in the public. No,
also within yourself?
Yeah. It was, I felt in the beginning intimidated, because why are people manifesting? And then I understood that they were not manifesting against our work or what. It was they simply that you can talk about it, but we still need more. This is something that I am really passionate about, you know, triggering action. And I think that the fact that people demonstrated outside for affordable housing being one of the planetary emergencies, it's necessary. I think that the publics need to ask for that. So my, implication with housing throughout the years in different ways, even having an exhibition here in this spring, you know, at the university, I think housing is a right, it's not a product. You can talk about it from the point of view of design, of course, but you need to talk about it from the point of view that is a human right. This is what I try to, let's say, work with in the academia, the university. On one side, design is great, but the students need to know that you are designing the hopes of people and that housing is, again, I insist, is a human right, just like education of healthcare, and that our governments need to take care of that. That leaving housing in the hands of super wood-willed real estate developers is not enough because we really need more. So this is something that I have been very, very much involved in the last decades, starting from May Plasti and my mentor, and then moving until now. And this is where the action comes. And then to Delft, you bring not only designers, you bring citizens and policymakers. You need to have the representative from the city of Delft and tell her, please, madam, have a look at these ideas. That's what we try to, or I try to do.
How do you actually do research within such a big project? How do you prevent being overwhelmed with all the options, all the information? And
yeah, as a researcher or curator or editor, I always tell my students the same thing. In order to move forward, you need to select. And sometimes you need to discard information, discard elements or topics. At the beginning, you want to touch upon everything. You want to, there's a lot of information, and then don't miss that, don't miss that, don't miss it. And then you can be very, very overwhelmed when it comes to research because I have no time to read all these books. I mean, let's look at the bibliography that has been done about this topic, no? And then you come with 100 books that you cannot read, no? Then come all these authors, all these others that have done that, all this material that is put together. I think the first thing that you need to do is to really choose what is your perspective on a certain topic. That's my agenda. I want to look at it from this point of view. I'm not going to look, for instance, at Melbourne from point of view of the relationship between the suburbs and the city, and then the CBD. I'm not going to look at it from the point of view of new housing strategies. I'm going to choose only one perspective. I have a whole territory to look at or try to find what the perspective, that's your agenda, your concern. And then you need to discard everything that doesn't talk about that because you can really end up very overwhelmed by the amount of, plus nowadays we have so much more information and it's so accessible. I always advise, okay, you have all these options, but now what's your agenda? Focus and move forward and you discard. Especially because many times all these projects that we are talking about, unfortunately, they are shorter and shorter. No, you have to deliver in, I don't know how much time. And then this is when the stress comes, you know, and the writer blocks it like so much. So I have learned to follow a certain intuition about a certain agenda or a certain perspective and discard everything that doesn't cover or talk about that agenda. Move forward knowing that you are leaving really good stuff, if I may call it like that, material, information, topics on the way. But you need to move forward. You want to have an exhibition that tells some story and you want to tell that story and you are missing a lot. And I know in all the books that I've done, all the exhibitions, I know that there's always criticism in the sense that you didn't talk about this. You should have talked about it. And I do the same when I go to an exhibition or when I read the book. Why not this? Why not that? I know better about this. Mm-hmm. Why did they call me? Of course, it's, again, pure human condition. But in my case, I have learned to understand that you cannot always please everybody. And that's something that it's difficult, huh? Sometimes you want to please everyone. It's really like that. That's really comfortable. But you have to learn that you cannot please everyone. You have done your best, you know, to move forward, kicking things aside, knowing that some parts of it are missing. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
With the BK talks and programs you're doing right now, you focus a lot on sharing knowledge, like you said. Sharing knowledge has a lot to do with network, and a lot of people in the field know you. How do you actually create a network, and what kind of tips do you have for students who are at the beginning or in the midst, and what kind of attitude could they embrace?
Mm-hmm. I think that before talking about the way I mean, before talking about the how, you know, there's social media and more and more and more and more. I would like to say that, for instance, I am a kind of person who has always been very, very, very good at keeping friendships for a very long time. Me being a person who has moved and lived in many, many countries. What happens is that you stop seeing people for years. And I've learned to keep friendship at a distance, no? And that requires you to very, very consistent or insistent or be pervasive. No, I can't find the word, no? But what I'm trying to say is that I have this friend of mine that I met in Argentina when I lived in and worked there in about 27 years ago. She came 2 weeks ago. And in 27 years, I think we have seen each other 3 times. And we keep contact. Same happens with everybody I met when I used to live in here or there, no? Keeping contact without expecting anything in exchange, I think is a virtue. That's the first thing I would, you know, because there's a certain trading side to networking, which I'm not so fond of. I think that you really need to build relationships without expecting anything in exchange, no? And this is what I've done with friends many years. Like, I was the one that always insisted. Sometimes that's not good, especially when it comes to romantic relationships, etc., etc., but let's not go there. So you need to keep, stay in touch, keep contact, know what the others are doing, no? I invite everybody to be very curious, for starters, no? And who is doing what you are doing or what you are interested in? And that's something that I ask my students to do. No? So you want to do a project about this or you want to read about that? Come on, be curious. Go to the library. Libraries are great, by the way. And we visit them less and less. No, check who do you think might be interesting for your research, for your concerns, to respond to your questions, etc. Build not only knowledge, but build a community of practice, if I may call it like that. Who are doing things you are interested in? Who are doing things you wouldn't do? And try to understand the work of others, no? And then, of course, you build relationships throughout work. And then, of course, some relationships stay, some others do not stay. What I have actually learned to do is to keep in very good terms with many of my collaborators throughout the 25 plus years that I've been working, no? I keep really good relationships from the first with the first people I used to work with, even though we never collaborated again. We are not expecting to collaborate again. But you never know that our paths can cross each other. Last week, somebody called me to write an article next fall in a journal, and we haven't spoken to each other in years, no? But the contact is there. I don't know, there's something that stays. And that's something that has to do with how you personally involve or engage with others while you're working. That's, I think, for me, there's no curriculum that covers that part. I think that you as a person need to cultivate that side of you without making it something that is a trading, but really make good connection, personal connection with those that are sitting next to you at work. I cannot work, for instance, without many times making very bad jokes, by the way. And sometimes my team, which is 20 years younger than I am, they say, come on, how can you keep telling those daddy jokes? But I know that if there was not this kind of non-tension in the room, I wouldn't like to work, no? And that's something that as a person, you need to learn to cultivate. Be a little bit more human. Use the power of verbal and nonverbal languages to make people around you comfortable. And that's something that some professionals don't manage so well to do. And my advice to professionals is that make sure that everybody in the room feels comfortable. Why establish hierarchy upon the arrival in the room? Why establish you versus them when you are in a place, no? And that's something that needs to be cultivated by all of us as professionals, no? And once everybody's comfortable, things flow much, 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 much better. People feel more creative. People don't feel censored. And then just open up, let's say, freely to ideas that sometimes I say, oh, that's a bit not such a good idea, but let's explore another one. But nobody feels offended because the boss or I think there are certain barriers which are human, not professional, that we need to take care of. I'm not talking about networks, but I think that then elaborating or keep in contact with all those that you have been working with is something that you need to learn to do. That's what I do. I'm not that great in social media. I have LinkedIn. There I publish every now and then what I do. Knowing that also what we see in LinkedIn, it's every positive, active aspect of our activity. There's never an issue or a problem that you had is almost never shown in LinkedIn. Fine. That's how it works. I just have Instagram, but it's a private account, which I only share with people that I have met in person. So I'm not that good there. But there are modes of making connections that go beyond, let's say, the tsunami of social media in which we are. No? That's how I connect.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bastian, for the project that you're doing. I think it's great. Thank you very much.
That was my conversation with Javier. From his early days navigating the world of architecture to becoming a key player in international institutions, Javier's story is a testament to trusting the process and embracing discomfort. He shared how important it is to challenge conventional ideas and why he believes real innovation comes from asking the right questions rather than rushing to the answers. Javier also opened up about the struggles of balancing creativity with structure and why collaboration fuels long-term success. His advice? Stay curious and never stop experimenting. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to click the follow button, rate the podcast, subscribe to the newsletter and spread the word so we can continue to grow the Don't Waste Eye podcast. And remember, everyone struggles and that's okay, but standing still prevents you from growing and reaching your potential. Keep moving forward because the better you become, the more you'll inspire others. Don't waste your time, don't waste your eye.